Peters, Mr. Bailey of the ANZ Banking Group, Mr. Ishiguro of the Bank of Tokyo, Mr. Barry Council of Florshine, Mr. Karam Bedi of Bata, India, and Mr. Kevin Luscombe of Thai Dairy Industries drew different aspects of the human face of regional business ventures. Some of the features of this human face, as they trace it out, included: one, building networks, long-term commitments, and personal contacts. Two, an awareness of the needs and aspirations of the region, not only in terms, but also not only in economic terms, but also in terms of quality of life. Three, sensitivity to the differences brought about by language and culture. Four, working to put something in and not just taking something out of that community. Five, establishing the ethical parameters for joint ventures, using the joint venture as a means for encouraging small and medium scale business. Six, developing pride in achievement, keeping close to the needs of the market, contributing to the host country's stack of technology and managerial skills. Seven, joint ventures as a manifestation of people who need people. We begin this morning by focusing our attention on three particular cases, which in a way spell out the Asian drama. This morning, we have three speakers with us who will show three different aspects and dimensions of that drama, speaking from their own experiences and trying to share this with us. The first speaker will be Mr. Dante Santos, who will dwell on the role of business in the people power revolution in the Philippines. Mr. Santos started his career here in Australia, he says 100 years ago. I don't know how that can be. Maybe that's how time has felt, or that's how long his wife feels she's been together with him. Now I have to be good to him. He paid for my trip here. Well, he was here as a young engineer to learn the technology for refrigerator manufacturing. And after that, he came back to Manila in 1952 and worked with Ismail Steel to put in practice what he had learned here, namely refrigerator manufacturing. Later in 1963, he put up his own company manufacturing refrigerators, and this has become one of the largest appliance company in the Philippines, and they manufactured GE brand, the White Westinghouse brand, and they are exporting this now. And in 76, he was active in various activities in the Philippines, including the Chamber of Industries. And he became president of the Chamber of Industries from 1983-1984. He had also been very active in a number of movements that led to the removal of President Marcos. He was the chairman of the Finance Committee of the National Movement for Free Election. He was a member of the Executive Committee of the Bishops Businessmen's Conference for Human Development. He is at present chairman of the board of the Government Service Insurance System. and is also chairman of the board of Philacor. He is president and chief executive of Philippine Airlines. He has been conferred honorary degrees in business management by D. De La Salle University. So may I call on Dante Santos.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My assignment this morning is to tell you about the role of the business of business in the people power revolution in the Philippines. In 1983, the year former Senator Benigno S. Aquino, affectionately known as Ninoy in the Philippines, was assassinated, someone wrote, "No social structure of injustice can withstand the power of people collectively enraged, united for a common just purpose, fighting for nothing less than life itself." Close quote. 3 years later, the Marcos regime collapsed. What was it that Ninoy said? "We only ask that freedom be returned. We ask nothing more, but we will accept nothing less." And how the Filipinos regained their freedom? There was no carnage, no serious bloodshed, no butchery. Huge armored personnel carriers were stopped by human barricades. People with no more than grim determination and courage stood unmoving in the face of loaded machine guns and M16s. They offered flowers, rosaries, and food to the enemy soldiers. This was the People Power Revolution, those glorious days in February 1986. Mostly, it was perceived as a revolt for the victory of good over evil, the last chance to save a morality built upon cultural heritage. It was outrage at the violation of Philippine mores, however mixed, contradictory, or syncretized, which was ultimately behind the revolt. It may not instantly lead to political stability in our country, nor economic recovery, but it did give the world a unique view of the people's resolve and determination. And what a curious revolution. It won us our freedom. The Aquino assassination, the fateful incident at the Manila airport in August 21, 1983, transformed a large part of the citizenry into a politicized majority. One shot, and the morals of a nation were offended. This time, someone had gone too far. Aquino may have insulted Marcos, but Marcos had insulted the Filipino people. The seeds of revolt had been planted. What used to be the activities of a politicized minority had become a more popular form of dissent. Businessmen, traditionally more concerned about their business interests, and therefore far removed from partisan politics, suddenly shed off their business prudence and political neutrality. At the premier financial center of the Philippines, business executives and employees led professionals, laborers, students, and religious groups in anti-government protests like the yellow confetti mass demonstrations, marches, and noise barrages. Something more was at work in the Philippines. The assassination, the flagrant disregard for law, the special privileges of a select few, the patronage, Marcos and his cronies' impossible wealth, all this was a slap in the face of the Filipino. Towards the end of Marcos' rule, public services was at an all-time low. The economy was destitute, the political regime so corrupt that the country was on the verge of collapse. Marcos thought he could stonewall this symbolism of excessive rule, of excessive money, of excessive lying. A moral imperative grew against Marcos and all he represented. It was then that rallies and demonstrations had become so massive, boisterous, and burdensome that a popular form of communication was born. Dubbed as the Parliament of the Streets, it was able to convey to the people the issues affecting them. Playing an active role in this Parliament of the Streets were citizens' movements that proliferated after the assassination. Among these were sectoral alliances from different levels of society, from the grassroots, the professionals, the businessmen, the laborer, the religious groups, youth, students, women, and cultural minorities. Radical groups took to the streets their ideological demands for structural reforms in political, economic, and social setup. These movements were not only in sympathy for the slain opposition leader, but more for the restoration of freedom and democracy, as well as common concerns for the national good. At that time, the demand for social and economic reforms were so great that this was made the rallying point of various cause-oriented groups in spite of the diverse causes they stood for. Broad-based movements mushroomed all over the country as people realized that unless they rely more on themselves and less on government, the corrupt authoritarian power structure will plunge the country to economic chaos and perhaps even into a violent and bloody ideological revolution. Movements went beyond tackling single issues to address basic holistic concerns. As the scope of concern widened, alliances under umbrella organizations were formed in order to have a better bargaining power. The business community, concentrated in Manila and stymied by the economic chaos which resulted from the drastic erosion of credit risk rating of the country, suspension of all trade facilities, and capital flight, led the upheaval. To a large extent, martial law and the tragedy of the assassination quickened the businessmen's awareness of the impact of political maneuvers on the well-being of society and the national economy. For the church, traditionally straddling the political milieu, the assassination of Benigno Aquino Jr. was the catalyst which altered its major thrust from promoting social reform to directly advocating political change. Thus, the businessmen and the church fought Marcos from the only political center they knew. Otherwise, they would have succumbed to the godless ideology of the communists on the left. To the businessmen, two questions may be asked. One, when and what role did Philippine business play in the people power revolution that changed the national leadership? Two, did businessmen in the pursuit for profits care less about the prospects of the greater good for the greater mass upon the imposition of martial law in September 1972? Perhaps at the beginning, a large number of businessmen throughout the country who had encountered severe difficulties because of nagging peace and order problems and interferences from political warlords during the late 60s and early 70s, there were hopeful anticipations that a shift from the democratic ways to authoritarian rule would suppress countryside lawlessness and political warlordism. But then, a handful of their breed took initiatives to address the increasingly serious social and economic problems that threatened Philippine society. Thus, in 1971, prior to the imposition of martial law, a group of 35 key business leaders and an equal number of bishops laid the groundwork for the formation of the Bishop Businessmen's Conference for Human Development. Their objective was to pool expertise, resources, and influence of church and business towards the economic, social, political, cultural, and spiritual transformation and development of Philippine society. In a consensus statement, they pledged to pursue the elusive goal of radical reform of a deeply divided and disjointed society through democratic and peaceful means. Upon imposition of martial law, the group at once saw the serious threats of authoritarian rule replacing the long-cherished democratic ways of life in Philippine society. They campaigned for support and were joined in progressively increasing numbers by businessmen, professionals, educators, community leaders, and members of the clergy from various parts of the country as martial law began to become more repressive. BBC undertook activities not in naked defiance to martial law and duly constituted authorities, but more to seek meaningful ways by which church and business might cooperatively seek relief and solutions to the worsening difficulty of human development in the country. One might therefore observe that long before it became fashionable to speak out against the abuses of the authoritarian rule, the BBC leadership lent the weight of its influence to statements decrying the excesses of the previous regime. They called for concrete steps from the business sector and the more fortunate of society to ensure that the less fortunate are provided minimum needs for human life and dignity. They conducted researches and surveys to obtain and make openly public readings of the negative imprint, moves that disrupted the free market forces, such as the formation of monopolies created by friends of the authoritarian power structure. They courageously took in policies which led to the dismantling of cherished democratic institutions and directives that suppressed dissent. Among these were the efforts to submerge the judiciary, the appointments for judges of lower courts and magistrates of the highest courts of the land, of individuals handpicked by Mr. Marcos for personal loyalty, and the use of the armed forces to perpetuate power by extension with the tenure of office of members of the military high command with proven personal loyalties. The BBC promoted awareness of the obligations of business to society and undertook efforts to transform practicing business managers and future business managers, students, into effective strategists for social development by encouraging them to include elements of business social responsibility in business planning and management. BBC efforts reached out to the grassroots communities through sponsorship of workshops on community development and livelihood among the rural entrepreneurs, the local officials, the educators, the clergy, and the citizenry. Resettlement and relocation problems of the urban poor were also addressed. These varied activities were demonstrations by which every sector of the community might take a more active role in the peaceful preservation of democratic ways in the country, as well as to resist the widespread and increasing repression of the martial law. The unraveling of government's version of the Aquino assassination by a Marcos-appointed fact-finding board, which concluded that the act was a military conspiracy, was still another way to show to the nation that Marcos was no longer able to manipulate the law. The institution of laws was once again increasingly made more powerful than the legalisms of Marcos. During the 1984 elections for the new members of the parliament, to replace the interim members who were voted several years before under questionable circumstances, there was already widespread view that political stability can be restored only by a credible government whose elective officials reflect the people's will expressed through clean, honest, and orderly elections. The BBC leadership snapped at the opportunity and formed the nucleus of the National Movement for Free Elections, the NAMFREL. The movement had the objective of harnessing the idealism and willingness to work and amid real danger and sacrifice by thousands of volunteers nationwide. Together with members of the clergy, groups of concerned businessmen and women campaigned for volunteers and solicited contributions throughout the country. The response from all sectors, including students, housewives, farmers, professionals, and many others, were not only spontaneous, but highly dedicated and generous. It is suggested that all these various activities of the BBC and the NAMFREL movement were the beginnings of the people peaceful revolution. NAMFREL volunteers throughout the country willingly took training to better know the election code and courageously kept vigil over the electoral processes to ensure that each step was followed in accordance with the provisions of the law. As a result, the once widespread coercion of voters, vote buying, and manipulation of election results were minimized resulting in 30% of the candidates independent of Marcos gaining seats in the parliament. This modest success of Namfrel during the parliamentary elections provided the needed impetus and popular support for the movement during the surprise announcement by Mr. Marcos of a snap presidential elections for early 1986. Namfrel volunteers increased many folds throughout the country. Businessmen not only campaigned for membership, but also volunteered members of their families and contributed their materials, funds more than 5 million pesos, while provincial businessmen funded their own local chapters. Never in the history of the country was there a tidal wave of involvement by businessmen and their employees, students, farmers, professionals, together with all members of their family and members of the clergy to ensure clean, honest, and orderly elections throughout the country. Widespread pressures from citizens forced the commission on elections, the COMELEC, to again officially accredit Namfrel as the citizens' arm of the COMELEC. Over the strong objections and threats from the Commission on Elections, Namfrel conducted its own independent count of election results, parallel with the COMELEC's official tally, to expose any manipulation of election results. Sure enough, the COMELEC tampered with the election results. This was announced by a number of computer operators who walked out in disgust. The COMELEC reported the victory of Marcos. In contrast, Namfrel's Operation Quick Count showed the trend of victory for the opposing candidate, Mrs. Corazon C. Aquino, the reluctant candidate and the widow of the assassinated former Senator Benigno S. Aquino, Jr. Despite the public outcry throughout the country about the manipulation of election results, the parliament, subservient to Mr. Marcos, proclaimed him and his running mate the victors. 2 weeks after the snap presidential election, with the people's disgust and outcry over the tampered election results still deafening throughout the country, the People Power Peaceful Revolution at EDSA was triggered in support of two of Marcos' high officials, Minister of Defense Ponce Enrile and Vice Chief of and Chief of Staff General Fidel Ramos, who indicted Marcos for tampering the election results, and together with some loyal followers, barricaded themselves at the constabulary headquarters. The same spirit of unity and bravery against the formidable odds that Namfrel volunteered displayed throughout the country during the snap presidential elections 2 weeks earlier were again displayed by businessmen, professionals, housewives, students, and many thousands who joined together and kept vigil for 3 nights and 2 days in defiance of the military forces dispatched to quell the two officials and the soldiers loyal to them. This unity among hundreds of thousands of brave citizens coming from all walks of life, armed only with flowers, rosary beads, crucifixes, and other religious images in defiance of fully armed soldiers and the fearsome instruments of war, finally turned the tide against the dictator. Mr. Marcos, together with his family and some cronies, fled the country. Consistent with the election results, a new democratic and refreshing national leader was installed by popular acclamation, President Corazon C. Aquino. To answer the President's call for selfless and dedicated support to the awesome and challenging mission of restoring the country's democratic institutions, rebuild the economy, and cure the ailments of society, many businessmen left more comfortable and better paying jobs in private business corporations and joined her in her government. Some of them are present with us here in this conference, led by Mr. Vicente R. Jaime, now Secretary of Finance, Mr. Jose Concepcion, now Secretary of Trade and Industry, Mr. Bienvenido Tan Jr., now Commissioner of Internal Revenue of the Philippines. These businessmen, together with their colleagues, will continue to play a vital role in the many challenges that face the Philippines. They were successful in the past, they will prevail again. Thank you.
The continuing Asian drama. We've just heard Dante Santos outline the role of business in the People's Power Revolution in the Philippines. Another phenomenon in Asia which we're witnessing are the group of countries commonly referred to as the newly industrializing countries, the NICs. Our next speaker will share with us their experience as a large, in fact, the largest computer company in one of the NIC countries, Taiwan. I think all of you know Taiwan has grown phenomenally, in fact, has a reserve of over $74-75 billion. Simon Lin, who is with us, is a member of the board of Acer Incorporated, the largest computer company in Taiwan. He has been with the company for 9 years, having held numerous positions in many areas of the operations, including sales, engineering, material management, and is now in charge of international sales and marketing. So may we request Mr. Simon Lin to discuss the growth of Multitech. Simon Lin.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. It's my great honor to be here to share with all of you about the story of Acer, formerly named Multitech, and to deliver to you some background of recently being emphasized a small but rich country, Taiwan, the Republic of China. First of all, I would like to give you how Acer been developed in the past 12 years and how the people in Acer playing on such a fast-growing and dynamic computer industry. Acer was founded in 1976 with $25,000 capital and 11 employees. Until end of 1987, the group wholly owns 9 companies with $71 million capital, employees 3,800 around the world, and consolidated turnover $331 million. In 1987. The business scope of Acer covers research and development, manufacturing, marketing, trading, publishing, education, and investment in high-tech areas. Since Acer has been enjoying compound annual growth rate of over 100% during the past years, certainly the product range has been widely expanded. Today, Acer is engaged in the product lines such as personal computers, Unix multi-user systems, data communications, bilingual computer systems, which is important for most of the Chinese, and we are now looking for another market in Japan. Peripherals and ASIC design, which is the most advanced technology in the world. These areas require our 550 engineers in research and development center working very hard and spending 5% of our annual turnover. In the meantime, ensure our target of $500 million revenue can be achieved in 1988. As the internationalization is concerned, we expand our operation and investment in USA, Hong Kong, United Kingdom, West Germany, Holland, and Japan. Invite the world investment institutes such as Chase Manhattan, Citicorp, Prudential Insurance, Hambridge and Quist, and Sumitomo to become Acer shareholders. All these activities end up a world recognition of number 10 personal computer manufacturer and number 5 8386 best computer supplier according